Hello, and welcome to Baltic Ways, a podcast bringing you interviews and insights from the world of Baltic studies. I'm your guest host, Ben Gardner-Gill, filling in for Dr. Indra Ekmanis. Tomas Filipović is a PhD candidate at the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge. He completed his MPhil in Politics and International Relations with distinction at the University of Cambridge in 2019, and he also holds a BA from King's College London. His current research focuses on small state influence in European multilateral organizations, particularly regarding the attempts of the Baltic states to position and assert themselves in the European foreign policy field. Tomas Filipović, welcome to Baltic Ways.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So let's just jump right in. As I said in bio, so you're looking at how the Baltic states interact on the European scene. Let's start with NATO. How have the Baltic states positioned themselves within NATO since the second Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022?
So thank you once again for inviting me on this podcast. It's a big honor. And I have to say that this is a time when the Baltic states broadly have experienced a surge of interest in the academic kind of international relations discipline, even in institution, old and ancient institutions like Cambridge, which generally would kind of neglect maybe regions, small states like the Baltics, which can be deemed to be kind of, you know, peripheral or marginal or some other unpalatable term. All of a sudden, the Baltics are in the Center for Geopolitical Studies at Cambridge. There's now a Baltic geopolitics program with its own budget for events and conferences and research. Of course, it all takes, this surge has come against the backdrop of an enormous tragedy, but I think it does create the opportunity to broaden awareness regarding Baltic geopolitical issues and concerns in fora, in institutions where there were no such opportunities previously. Turning to your question, I think we need to understand first the ways in which the Russian invasion resonated with the Baltic states to understand their behavior. And of course, Russia's February 24th re-invasion, I guess you could say, or second invasion, really struck a nerve in the Baltic states, really triggering this deepest insecurity, this idea that the darkest nightmare is coming true. And this nightmare is rooted in this kind of historical sense, historical fear of ally abandonment following the Second World War. So even now in 2022, there were kind of hushed whispers. I was in Riga myself, hushed whispers in not only in IR discussions, but in bars and kitchens, kind of, will our allies come to our aid? Is NATO's Article 5 really just a paper tiger, or how real is it? Would really the Americans or the Brits, you know, spend their blood and tears and resources to protect us? Maybe a bit of an anecdote, but also 2 weeks ago, I attended a really sold out play in Riga in a Daila theater, which in Latvian is called Kurpazu Davalsts, which could be translated to something. Where did the state go? Or like, where did we lose the state? Which kind of sketches out a comparative analysis of the last days of interwar Latvia in 1940 of the Ulmanist regime, where it was faced with the Soviet ultimatum, kind of what to do. Do we allow Soviet bases? Do we not? Do we resist? Is resistance futile? Is it not? And of course, the two mistakes that were identified in Baltic interwar foreign policy. First one would be that cooperation between the Baltic states was nearly non-existent, despite ambitious rhetoric of all sorts of Baltic entente and pooling resources and all of that. Really, this did not materialize. And the second is that the Baltics pursued this ill-fated kind of neutrality policy, hoping that just like maybe Switzerland, if we maybe just keep our heads down, the scary winds will blow over and the Germans and the Russians will somehow, you know, resolve their own issues. Of course, today, or really this invasion, the situation in the Baltic states is totally different from 1940, even despite those historical insecurities floating up. First, the cooperation between the Baltic states is really excellent and all maybe as good as it's ever been, honestly. And all indications after yesterday's election result in Estonia is that under the current governments, this cooperation, I think, will continue. The second In stark contrast to 1940, the Baltic states are, of course, not alone. Far from it, nor have they been abandoned. They're really enveloped in the Western security architecture offered by NATO and the EU. Sorry for this long-winded intro, but so now this leads me to your question. And I think that, crucially, the way the Baltic states have responded since the second invasion is really through showing leadership, through showing initiative in providing significant diplomatic, military, and humanitarian support to Ukraine. And this is not out of, I think, just kind of noble or generosity of heart reasons. I think it's based on a quite rational, calculated conclusion that the fate of Ukraine, so to say, the security of Ukraine, is directly tied to that of the Baltic states and of NATO. So I think a crucial dimension that should be understood is that amidst this deterioration of the security environment, which of course threatens the security of the Baltic states, the Baltics have really responded by not just asking for assurances or asking for some sort of hand-holding, so to say. Of course, although that is also part of the kind of, that must be part of the response from the Baltic perspective, bolstering allied presence, allied infrastructure, allied support. But the Baltics have placed the onus on showing solidarity themselves. And of course, with the entire security agenda of NATO now focused on the East, this has created more opportunities for Central Eastern European states. I think Poland should be especially acknowledged in this regard, but also for the Baltics to shape the agenda. So maybe just a couple concrete points, you know, Latvia and Estonia are really setting the bar kind of globally, donating 1% of GDP. That is an enormous share to Ukraine. Military budget donations, I looked up the latest figures. Estonia has donated 44.5% of its defense budget. Latvia, 39.9%. Lithuania, 25%. That is astronomic. That is really extraordinary, especially for small states like the Baltic states, which are not like, you know, the US, which can just fire up their military industrial production as required. And crucially, the Baltics, with their quite, you know, I would say, prescient analysis about developments within Russia and about the threat posed by the Putin regime, they were actually among the countries that sent weapons to Ukraine even prior to the February 24th invasion date. So a couple weeks ago, I heard a speech from the Ukrainian ambassador in Riga, and he really, really praised the Baltics' contributions in terms of sending javelins and this type of arms, which played a really crucial role in the early kind of battle for Kyiv, which is arguably one, at least certainly one of the most important turning points of the war, when the situation was really so fraught, so unstable. So I apologize for a bit, yeah, ranting, but basically, I think the level of solidarity shown by the Baltic states is remarkable. And this has certainly been noticed across NATO, across Europe, and I would say also across the ocean. If the small Balts can step up and show this sort of solidarity, then that kind of really sets the tone for others to follow. I think maybe one final point, I think about this solidarity being noticed. I really don't think it's a coincidence that President Biden chose to give his speech on the anniversary of the war in Poland. I think it's a strongly symbolic kind of step. And of course, bringing together the Bucharest 9, which includes the Balts as well, really, really showing that there's a new energy in transatlantic security cooperation, in cooperation between the US and its Central Eastern European allies. And the Baltic states, I think, are really featuring prominently within this newly energized partnership.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was far from a rant. That was very descriptive. I appreciate that. So I'm just going to jump in right from the newly energized portion, as you put it. Obviously, the Russian invasion of 2022 changed NATO's structures, its focus, goes without saying. The Baltic states have taken a new role within NATO, goes without saying. What was it like before the invasion? And like, what did it really just take the invasion to change this? Like, I guess, why are people listening to the Baltic states now?
Excellent question. And again, so many directions I could really take this in. But if we do kind of, yeah, maybe if I should set kind of the table in terms of the historical context, of course, when the Baltic states regained independence and they positioned EU and NATO accession as the overarching kind of strategic foreign policy objective, there would be this idea that as they pursue this return to Europe And as once they gain membership, there will be this kind of Fukuyama-ish end of history, right? That they would be happily in the alliance. There would be no more gray zones. It would be clear Russia is there, EU and NATO is there, and we will have this kind of golden age cooperative security with Russia, where we will now solve international threats. We will solve terrorism with Russia together. We will maybe work on climate change, space cooperation, all the good stuff. However, in the coming years, even after they gained independence, even after they became members of the EU and NATO, relationship between the Baltic states and Russia arguably became more confrontational. So all sorts of antagonistic high-level rhetoric in at the UN and those types of OSCE and those fora, so-called memory wars over the history of the Second World War, energy cutoffs, militarization in the region, and other sorts of conflictual dynamics. And of course, as the Baltic states even brought up worrying developments within Russia, kind of calling out rapid erosion of democracy, curtailing civil liberties. These concerns were not really aligned with the European mainstream or the Western mainstream, which, as I said, was focused on this cooperative security with Russia. And this was actually under both Republican and Democratic administrations in the US. So the Baltic insecurity vis-a-vis Russia was not really solved by the virtue of membership. And even as we had the kind of first wake-up call that wasn't in Georgia, when the Baltic states said, look, this is really a game changer. You know, the Baltic states really tried to feature prominently even in showing solidarity with Georgia, sending their presidents, right? And I believe Prime Minister of Latvia went to Tbilisi at the height of the conflict, only for them to kind of be sidelined by Sarkozy Medvedev's 10-point plan with their own bilateral initiative. And then we see, you know, this kind of very quick restoration of relations with Russia. So no sanctions were imposed. And, you know, of course, there were other factors at play, 08 financial crisis, not really much appetite to sanction Russia in any kind of meaningful way. So then when we have 2014, already alarm bells start to ring in Europe. I remember, as a result, I had an interview with a quite high-ranking Estonian diplomat recently, who said that once the really large sanctions packages were implemented, the first large sanctions packages against Russia were implemented, an Italian diplomat came up to him and said, well, kind of, I hope you're happy. Now your policy on Russia has become like the EU's policy. So we see that all of a sudden kind of Baltic policy preferences are being seen as less and less marginal. They're slowly being incorporated into the mainstream. At the same time, still the Baltic approach was still seen as radical, right? So at the diplomatic political context level, it was still conducted in this Normandy format, you know, kind of big boys dealing with the big boys. The Baltic states were seen more as spoilers maybe of the agenda, a bit too hawkish. And so this is something I think that we're now beginning to see really completely alter, a complete kind of alignment of Baltic analysis and European mainstream analysis, that gradually there has been a convergence. So in 2008, it was not at all kind of did not really leave like a lasting impact. 2014 was already a crucial inflection point. And now over these coming years, and now tragically in 2022, we see this confirmed at the highest levels. We see von der Leyen, we see Michel, we see, you know, Scholz, Macron even, I believe, all the kind of main Western leaders saying something along the lines of Baltics, acknowledging the validity in the Baltic analysis. I think what has been crucial, though, is that I believe that somewhat successfully the Baltics have avoided the snatching the low-hanging, tempting fruit of kind of saying, we told you so, and kind of, you know, dancing on this sort of capitalizing on the situation for political, cheap political gain, because of course nobody likes to be told that they're wrong, right? And the Baltic states still need to recognize that. Of course, they're now in a much more credible position. Their voices are now being seen as more valid and credible, yet nevertheless, size and sheer capabilities, and that, of course, those are still relevant factors. So they need to be careful about how they position themselves within that constellation moving forward.
Absolutely. And they certainly have an eye, I see as well, to, you know, this war is going to be over at some point. And after Ukraine's victory, as we say, you know, how are EU and NATO going to move forward and look at what is going to be a fundamentally changed security architecture, right? There's no returning back to what we had for the years in between the Cold War and this invasion. It's going to be something different. In that context, then, in how the Baltic states have been positioning themselves in the last year plus in particular, would you say, or what do you think about, you know, this new elevated Baltic stance in security affairs? Is it temporary? Is it going to be a little longer lasting? Is it really just dependent on the war in Ukraine, or is that more of the catalyst to get them into this position in these debates? What could throw it off? Are, you know, basically, are they going to retain this position where they're really actually listened to and their ideas are at the forefront of these multilateral conversations?
Well, I think first, even before we touch upon the Baltic aspect, I think what has really been one of the most important, not just lessons, but also lasting impressions that will endure this war, is the fact that one of the clear lessons in all of this is that alliances matter. And so if we remember, you know, as recently as 2019, I won't say who, but there were some pontificating about, you know, brain death of NATO, or saying that, you know, or even, you know, rightfully so, pointing to really, you know, murky legacies of Afghanistan and on some sorts of, you know, international adventures, let's put it that way. There were questions about, you know, oh, is NATO really fit for purpose? Is NATO relevant? Is it just a cumbersome bureaucracy? What purpose does it serve since the end of the Cold War and so on? Well, now the position which has always been held by the Baltic states has now, I think, been firmly reinforced that NATO is relevant. And this links, I think, to the first question that I was talking about this new energy in transatlantic security cooperation. And it, I think, very much aligns with the Baltic vision of it. So there's much less fantasizing about European strategic autonomy, you know, or this kind of thing about decoupling from the US, divesting from the US, which quite a few voices on the continent were calling for, which was, of course, not what the Baltic states would be in favor of. So I think that this reconfiguration really favors the Baltic states' preferences moving forward. Of course, another aspect that we cannot just kind of neglect is, of course, the actual situation in Ukraine, right? And I think that that will also directly impact how things shake out moving forward. More than a year now into this bloody tragedy, we see zero indications that Putin is kind of changing his strategic objectives, that he is in any way relinquishing the goal of conquering Ukraine, dominating it, destroying its sovereignty, destroying its independence. At the minimum, it appears that, you know, Putin is still intending on recapturing the entire territory of Donetsk and Lugansk regions, and also consolidating gains in, you know, Zaporizhia and Kherson. And, you know, there is already an ongoing Russian offensive as we speak today. So I think that we need to prepare for a really protracted war. I don't see any kind of quick, you know, even ceasefire or any kind of initiative like that. And I think a quite stark, sobering reality in this regard is that the way the situation plays out on the front line will also impact the weight of certain policy positions within the EU and within NATO. So, for instance, if Ukraine can withstand this current Russian offensive and then continues to make progress in liberating territories, then the reality is simple. Then it will simply have more and more allies. If Ukraine can show gains, if Ukraine can show progress, you know, with the, you know, new weapons, with the new types of munitions and technologies it's receiving, then it will have more allies, and the voice of the Baltics will then be raised and more stronger and prominent. If Russia starts to succeed and push back, then, you know, more and more of these kind of fake, like, peace doves, you know, like China and Russia will start to dominate, or, you know, Lukashenko, or maybe some other, I don't know, some other brokers, India, maybe some other voices calling for peace. I'm doing quotation marks. I know that it's some India. We'll start to prop up, right? We already see now that China is offering its, I believe, 12-point peace plan, which is without really consulting Ukraine meaningfully on it. So that is the kind of sobering reality, is that Ukraine has to succeed on the battlefield. Ukraine really has to succeed. It has to make progress in order for all of this, all of this kind of necessary progress that we have made in reforming, reoriented the Euro-Atlantic security architecture, in order for that progress to be real and lasting, Ukraine has to win, at least certainly from the perspective of the Baltic states. There's really no viable alternative. There's no scenario in which Ukraine fails, but the Baltic states are kind of saying, well, good thing we're part of the alliance. I think that has been a point that has been quite masterfully, consistently communicated between Baltic politicians and foreign policymakers and the populations, saying, really linking the fates of Ukraine and the Baltic states.
Absolutely. That has been a very, very consistent line of messaging, multilateral line of messaging from the Baltic states, Poland as well, as you said.
I actually thought of one more point that is super relevant in this regard. One lasting transformation that is certainly going to happen that will strongly enhance the positioning of the Baltic states within NATO is, of course, the accession of Sweden and Finland. That is going to happen, certainly, sooner or later. And that, of course, I'm sure this has already been, of course, discussed in you know, previous episodes of the podcast, and it's nothing groundbreaking for all of you experts of Baltic studies, but that will certainly not only add strategic depth to the alliance, really consolidate logistics and all sorts of security provisions in the Baltic Sea region, but it will also just elevate the concerns of the Baltic states within the alliance, because Sweden and Finland largely, of course, they have some other matters, you know, like Arctic security and so on, but broadly, they really, really share our concerns. So it will be just super helpful to have two more friends, two more closest partners at the table.
Yeah, exactly. And two strong militaries in the European context as well. I mean, both the Swedes and the Finns have just in terms of arms and conventional capacity, you know, they're adding a plus to NATO by joining, not to mention, of course, the same mindset, let's say, on a lot of these things. So, I mean, with them considered, as well as sort of the broader Central and Eastern European support for Ukraine, this consistent messaging, as you say, you know, has this lent credibility to these countries, of course, particularly the Baltic states, as we're discussing, in other multilateral discussions. Obviously, Ukraine is top of mind, rightfully so, but there are other things that have to be discussed at the same time. The European Union still has lots of other things to debate about and to argue over and to do and not do. So has this episode, as sad as it is, lent credibility to the Baltic states in other areas outside of the direct security conversation?
Excellent question. And I think just to make sure that this episode does not turn into too much kind of patting ourselves on the back, I think I will maybe try to address this question from two kind of points of unfinished homework, two issues that remain ongoing pressing priorities. And so one, I think, effort or one battle that has maybe gone a bit below the radar, just because this organization has been bashed in all sorts of ways, I think some less deserved than others, and it's at the UN. At the UN, where the Baltic states have really worked to draw nature to the colonial nature of Putin's war in Ukraine. So it's maybe obvious for you, me, and the listeners, but what really strikes me about the way Putin has conducted his aggression, his special military operation in Ukraine, is that it's not just been the pursuit of, you know, kind of strategic military objectives. It's that there's been a deliberate effort to destroy the basis of kind of Ukrainian identity, that these occupying, marauding armies, they deliberately destroy cultural monuments, libraries, theaters, schools. They forcibly Russify the occupied territories, force like passportization. They ban Ukrainian language. One of the first things they do is they destroy like telecommunications towers and impose this kind of informational iron curtain, only access to the Russian information space. And of course, there are significant evidence of, you know, literally ethnic cleansing, maybe even genocide. So I think that the point that the Baltic states, where they have tried to kind of draw on their own experience of colonial subjugation, colonial domination, is to really try to expand the global coalition that will be required ultimately in order to defeat Putin's Russia. At the end, of course, the West, let's say, is more or less united. But what we will really need is to globally isolate Russia. And this is, we sometimes forget that the world is not just, you know, the EU and the US and, you know, some other maybe actors around the external borders. No, the UN is 193 member states. And disappointingly, thus far, quite a few states with their own, you know, who have suffered from the tragic crimes of colonialism, dozens of states across Africa and Latin America. Unfortunately, I believe we as the collective West have underappreciated the degree to which Russian and Chinese disinformation has kind of penetrated those countries. And we have not yet been completely successful in making the case that, look, what Putin is doing to Ukraine is exactly what you have been through and what we have been through. I think that that is the kind of a really, really crucial effort moving forward. As you said, leveraging credibility from one place to another. I think some other things that one other crucial point that needs to be underscored is that I believe there is a risk of falling into some sort of complacency, which I believe the Baltic states actually have no room for. Sure, Ukrainians have really, you know, heroically withstood Russian aggression and, you know, recovered, made really remarkable gains in recovering some territory. But really, the Ukrainians have bought the Baltic states time. That is what really has happened. And there's so much unfinished homework. So one is, of course, you know, literally strengthening national defense capabilities. So already there are discussions, I think, in all three Baltic states about, you know, raising military expenditure to 2.5 or even 3% of GDP. And there are all sorts of weaknesses, right? Most glaring is, of course, air defense. I think, you know, we shouldn't really be surprised by what Russia is doing after, you know, Chechnya and Aleppo and all sorts of other cases. But I think it's really, really striking, even for the defense planners in the Baltic states, that Russia would really kind of literally, you know, shell kindergartens and shell electric grids and critical infrastructure and that sort of thing. So for the Baltic states, of course, closing those vulnerabilities is an urgent priority. Coast Guard, you know, even border security, that is civil defense. You know, another priority is, of course, yeah, working on strengthening the allied footprint in the region. I think in this case, a useful opportunity is the fact that the next NATO summit will be in Vilnius in Lithuania. That is, of course, you know, somewhat symbolic, but it generally, from my understanding, the host nation does have, you know, maybe the opportunity to move the agenda, even if it's about like one percentage point, a bit tilt the agenda in its favor. And of course, just, you know, strengthening resilience domestically. There is so much to be done. I'm maybe a bit more familiar with the Latvian context than the other Baltic states, but, you know, there are really questions about the types of information that is available to the Russian-speaking community in Latvia. One thing is to ban Kremlin and Russian state-sponsored TV channels, which was done, I believe, a very, very valuable step. But, you know, it's easy to ban something and much more complicated to offer something quality in its place. So I think, but there is no political consensus on offering something like this because, you know, there are concerns about the positions of the Latvian language and about it being endangered and that sort of thing. So I believe Estonia is ahead in this regard. Estonia, I think, has allocated, I think, about 2 million per year to its public broadcaster to create quality content in the Russian language. All sorts of other domestic resilience questions, lots of unfinished homework. But I believe when it comes to Ukraine, the Baltic states have really, really positioned themselves on the right side of history. And what remains to be seen is whether they will kind of seize the window of opportunity created by the Ukrainians to really, really make smart, lasting investments in their own security.
Absolutely. And I think with that forward-looking note, that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for joining us. I've learned a lot. I know our listeners have as well. Tomas, thank you so much, and Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава. Thank you so much. I hope to see you at the big conference you have this year.
Yeah, I'll be there in Kaunas.
Excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll see you then. We'll be in touch.